Good morning, everybody.
Good morning.
We are past Easter. We made it through Easter. One more year. Very good. Thinking about what time we have left between now and when the class will end for the summer, break for the summer. We have about 5 weeks, I think. And so my intention for this morning is just to spend one more moment with prophets. We'll first look at Isaiah, and then we'll try to make a jump to Elijah, if we have time to talk about that. And then I want to spend the remaining weeks, we should probably talk about the big guy, and see, you know, when God speaks to the big guy, how does that go? And we also, I want to maybe give a nod to Paul, because of the way he has shaped the New Testament, and we want to kind of listen a little bit there. I also want to at least give a nod to the Holy Spirit as the ongoing speaking activity of God in the church. And then I also want to spend just a little time talking about, well, how can we wrap our heads around what we've had in this class for the past several months? It's flying. Time flies. I think when I sat down to plan the lessons, I thought, man, I got all kinds of time. And here I am stuck in the prophets. I can't get over to the New Testament. So it's because of our dialogue and the richness of how you're participating. So if you want to open up your Bibles to Isaiah chapter 6, we're going to be looking at the great prophet of Israel. The book of Isaiah is considered the high form of ancient Hebrew poetry. I don't know if you knew that or not, but the book of Isaiah is lauded as an art form in Scripture. And it is primarily a poetic text with a little bit of prose in there. And when we talk about Isaiah as a prophet in his ministry, when he was serving the nation, it was after the fall of the north. And so things are really in decline. And there's a sense that what is left is not going to hold. And I want to talk a little bit about his calling. And then kind of what is always in that prophetic impulse of what God is trying to speak in so that it might be spoken out. We'll kind of play with that. So just to give you a little bit of backdrop about Isaiah and knowing that we're encountering a poetic text, all of that I want you to kind of think about a little bit as we get into Isaiah 6. So let me read it. It's a short and rather cryptic text, and we'll let it just hit our ears and listen to what we see in there. And share it together. Isaiah chapter 6. In the year that King Uzziah died, I saw the Lord seated on a throne, high and exalted, and the train of his robe filled the temple. Above him were seraphs, each with 6 wings. With 2 wings they covered their faces, with 2 they covered their feet, and with 2 they were flying. And they were calling to one another, "Holy, holy, holy is the Lord Almighty. The whole earth is full of his glory." At the sound of their voices, the doorposts and thresholds shook, and the temple was filled with smoke. "Woe to me," I cried, "I am ruined, for I am a man of unclean lips, and I live among a people of unclean lips, and my eyes have seen the King, the Lord Almighty." Then one of the seraphs flew to me with a live coal in his hand, which he had taken with tongs from the altar. With it, he touched my mouth and said, "See, this touched your lips. Your guilt is taken away and your sin atoned for." Then I heard the voice of the Lord saying, "Whom shall I send? And who will go for us?" And I said, "Here I am. Send me." He said, "Go and tell this people, be ever hearing but never understanding, be ever seeing but never perceiving. Make the heart of this people calloused, make their ears dull and close their eyes. Otherwise they might see with their eyes and hear with their ears, understand with their hearts and turn and be healed." Then I said, "For how long, O Lord?" And he answered, "Until the cities lie ruined and without inhabitant, until the houses are left deserted and the fields ruined and ravaged, until the Lord has sent everyone far away and the land is utterly forsaken. And though a tenth remains in the land, it will again be laid waste. But as the terebinth and oak leave stumps when they are cut down, so the holy seed will be the stump in the land." All right. So this is kind of like a job interview. Right? For a prophet. Tell me what this text is doing here, what it's communicating, how God is speaking, what jumps out to you with this calling or commission of Isaiah? Cryptic stuff.
I think in verse 2, where it says, with two wings they cover their faces, with two they cover their feet.
Yeah.
And then it refers to that again in verse, where is it later over here? Oh, he says, I cover those. The uncleanness.
Yeah.
The uncleanness.
Yeah.
Before God, the eyes are unclean, the feet are unclean, so...
Yeah.
The seraphs come before in that manner to God's glory, hiding the unclean.
Yeah, good. And the word that the Bible kind of hovers around in this regard is holy.
Yes.
Holy. When we think of holy, a lot of us have had the heritage of what does it mean to be holy? It means to be morally what? Perfect? But that's not at all kind of how this word is locating. In other words, they're talking to one another across the king's court saying, holy, holy, holy is the Lord. And notice that he fills all the earth with his glory. So this is not just an ethereal experience, but this is about how the two worlds are communicating. And the holiness, in light of who Isaiah feels he is, and the seraphs, in some sense, saying, even us have to hide. Because God is other, right? He's the other. So I also like this word for holy, strange. God is strange. I don't know if you think of him that way, but every time I feel comfortable with God, I try to remember he's holy and say, well, no matter how comfortable I might feel with him, there's an otherness of God that prevents me from kind of fully wrapping around him, leaning into Jesus a little bit, saying, I can't get there. Because of who you are. So we see this language. What else in the text is interesting about this call of Isaiah?
There was a cleansing process.
Yeah, that's good. So the sin and the cleansing. And we're using the image of a coal. Okay? Coal to the mouth, to the tongue. If you are burned, you ever been burned on your tongue? You tend to talk a little funny afterwards. There's an accent, so to speak. Like, right? But there is this sense of how you spoke before will be changed by the experience of being purified. I've taken care of it. Okay. What else? What else is interesting about this interaction between God and Isaiah and the panoply?
He's looking for a volunteer.
Yeah, that's strange, isn't it? Yeah. It's like, okay, now that we went through all of this pomp and circumstance... And Isaiah, I don't know if this is registering with you or not, nudge, nudge, but I need somebody to go. This has a weird quality to that. There is a sense of freedom. Which is to say, God may bring upon you a sense of the divine, an experience of who he is, but it still doesn't leave you checked at the door with your freedom. You must take it up.
You have choice.
You have choice. Yeah.
I like, and it probably has something to do with freedom, the idea that before it's a woe to me and then here I am.
Yeah.
I mean, he completely changes.
Yeah. Yeah, and there's a relationship between freedom and cleansing.
Mm-hmm.
Isn't there? Mm-hmm. So it's not that you're just free from the old stuff,
right.
But you have now this agency to thou choose the things of God, to act in a way that God is asking you to act, that the cleansing moment creates a new possibility.
Frank, there's a lot of differences in the translations.
Sure.
Especially in verse 10.
Mm-hmm.
And some people will have footnotes, some will not. But you know, the Greek version reads very different when I was looking through this. Go and say to people, when you hear what I say, you will not understand. When you see what I do, you will not comprehend, for the hearts of these people are hardened. One version, it almost as if he is saying, I'm causing this to be this way.
That's right.
In one way, it's reading, people will choose to be this way.
Yeah.
And so you see God in two different ways.
Yeah.
And I'm I know you don't get into translation.
Yeah, I really try to avoid all these kind of questions. But yeah, I think in terms of what the text and the translators are struggling with is, how is this presenting God? And are there options in the language itself to bring God along this side and say God is kind of not really the one causing this, but they're choosing it? Or on the other side, saying God is the agent. He is causing the hardening. You go back to the Moses story.
Yes.
Don't you hear that same echo? Which is Pharaoh is... Who's hardening Pharaoh's heart? Is Pharaoh doing it? Or is God doing it? You go with Saul, what do you get? The Spirit's removed from him, and he deteriorates. Who did that? Did God do that? Did Saul do that? Those are when... For translators, and particularly if you have a theological tradition, if you're more reformed, where you're okay with some of this stuff a little bit more, sovereignty of God, versus maybe an Arminian tradition where you're concerned with human freedom a little bit, you're going to translate those words a little bit.
Right, and even when we talk about the twins,
yeah,
this one I loved and this one I hated.
Yeah.
I mean, I had twins, so that's kind of hard. I mean, yeah. I'm kind of looking at that going, okay, how do you love?
Yeah.
Yeah,
especially in the Old Testament. Yeah. There is a sense of the chosen people, the not-so-chosen people, the people that are going to survive, the people that are going to get wiped out. Where is God's ownership of this, right? So you're seeing the translators in this moment going, I don't know, I think I need to kind of lean this way into the Hebrew a little bit to present God in a certain way. I'm going to lean this way a little bit because I think it should be this way. But the dynamic of being stubborn, there is a sense, especially in the prophets, that God increases stubbornness in order to create a radical hope. In other words, if God were not involved in the cloudiness of it, then the penetration of the light when it comes kind of comes down a notch. So to say, I will harden them because the miraculous move of hope will be that much more distinct and holy. You can see, theologically, people saying, I think that's maybe why the text wants to wrap that way.
Yeah, I always struggle with that concept, though, because now you're getting into the situation of the individual versus the whole.
That's right.
Of where God is, which is, I will use people for my purpose, even if it creates struggle in their life.
Yeah, that's right.
To teach a greater purpose.
Yeah, and it's, I'm not saying this is an easy teaching, for sure. One of the words they use to describe this is determinism. I can get all the vowels. Determine. There it is. Without the I, somewhere in there. Which is to say, life is a series of dominoes. And the only person that plays with the dominoes is who?
God.
We're just a domino.
Yeah.
Right? Or some people say, God can't see things quite that way. While he's in control, human agency is affecting the course of history. Now, which one do you like better?
B.
You like B sort of better? Yeah, I mean...
Well, there's a third element, though.
And which one's the third?
And that's the sequel to God at War book that Gregory Boyd wrote.
Uh-huh.
It's called Satan and the Problem of Evil.
Yes, yes, yes. And there's also the sense of, do we put it all on Satan as he's the one screwing everything up? You know, because that's a little bit of a problem with determinism, which is to say, you start to give Satan this much power, and all of a sudden he's running the show. And God's back down. So, again, no easy answer to this stuff, and this is why I don't like to answer these questions. But you do see the translators responding to this in the text.
Hey, Mom, did he avoid issues when he was a young boy, too?
She's going to love that one. Thanks for that. So, in terms of the prophetic utterance and wrestling with this, what is the blend of the prophetic move has two poles to it, just to help you with this a little bit. But the prophets will always speak of judgment, but it will always be connected to hope. So when you read a prophet thinly, you may collapse one of those and say, here comes the judgment. But I think when you step back in the canon and you listen to the prophets, and especially with Isaiah, right? I mean, Isaiah's got all kinds of hope passages tucked in there. You'll hear the judgment saying, what is going on is not in the will of God, it's not in the plan of God. In order to get this to move back into the trajectory, here's the hope. God does not eliminate suffering to get there. He may even, in some sense, create an agent to come in and create suffering, like the Babylonians, like the Assyrians. But ultimately, is God just interested in judgment? Not that I've seen, in the sense that judgment is going somewhere. It's part of the redemptive process. If you never bother to judge, you can't know where hope is. This is one of the things that concerns me about even our sense of contemporary spirituality now, is that we have to have mechanisms to confess. You don't want to just throw that away. Because when you learn the mechanisms of confession, in the classic sense of Christianity, hope becomes real. You confess towards something. And with a prophet, they do the same thing. They pronounce judgment, not for the sake of suffering, but to say, this is not all that there is. And the way out is through hope, what God has in mind. It's radical trust. I saw it coming.
Yeah, I think, you know, we have a much larger role than we want to think that
yes,
we have.
Yeah.
And Isaiah's hitting on that here
big
time.
Yes.
And the bottom line is what I see him saying is, how are you going to reflect the image of God?
Yeah.
And the answer should be a personal thing. I should see this, I think, as him talking specifically to me. And the way that I reflect God's image is obedience.
Yeah.
That's a huge responsibility.
Yeah.
And on the other side of that, it is not me being judgmental of anybody else.
Yeah.
That's God's deal.
Yeah.
That's what Isaiah's saying.
I'm absolved from that.
That's right.
Yeah, exactly.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's God's deal. But it does lie upon me the obligation to reflect him by being obedient.
Yeah, that's good. And there's something else about Isaiah being primarily poetry that I want to tease out. Because this could have been codified in a prose style, where it would have been something much more analytical about what it means to be a prophet. And there are other prophetic stories, probably why I want to turn to Elijah a little bit, because he's more of a prose story. But what is it about poetry that's different than prose? If we can take a literary term for a second. What makes poetry different?
Poetry allows you interpretation of your thought.
Yeah. There's space maybe in poetry. Interpretation. But you can interpret a prose text a little bit. I mean, you can, just as we did just a moment ago, right?
There's imagery, there's...
Yeah, good. There's other things being used, right? There's a lot of imagery.
There's rhythm.
Rhythm, yeah.
Good, rhythm.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Memory.
Yeah, good.
Connected to your memory.
Really good poetry, just to kind of get you in a world that you can't necessarily access with not having the Hebrew in front of you, and I don't necessarily want to make that available, but poetry tricks your brain. Poetry, good poetry, says, here's the way we're going to go. Excuse me, bad poetry goes this way. Here's the way we're going to go, and you can kind of predict the next word. Good poetry disrupts that.
Rap versus
hippopotamus. Why is hippopotamus the word here? It should be rap, right? But in poetry, in the sense of what it does to the mind, one of the reasons poetic form is useful for the prophet is because it can allow an interruption of thought and something new to come in. So it's not just ideas. It's that when you're reading a poetic text, your brain's saying, I can tell you where this is going to go. Wait a minute. It shouldn't have gone over there. And it makes you stop. The reason I think Isaiah partly is in a poetic form is to present the radical hope of God as an interruption against the text they're experiencing. To say, let me give this in the form of a poem because it will open up your own belief in the hope of God and what he's trying to do and what he's trying to accomplish. So don't let that slide. We're used to reading things very analytically. Mm-hmm. Even when we get into a poetic text, we tend to be an analyzer of the poetic text. And just allow at least the possibility that it's preserved in this kind of cryptic and imagistic form for your own mind to go, wait a minute, I can't quite hang with this. I can't have control over this text. The text is doing something else. Do you want to jump to Elijah? Because this is it for the prophets. Or do we want to make another comment on Isaiah? All right. I'll take that as a vote. And we'll go to 1 Kings 19 now. Let's go to a narrative. We're going to go back in time. 1 Kings 19 to the ministry of Elijah. If you remember the sequence of the stories with Elijah, Elijah's coming off, and he doesn't have a long run in the book of 1 Kings. There's several chapters dedicated to him, which is more than most. He's just coming off this rather dramatic victory, right? Do you remember the altars, and you get your prophets, and I'll do my thing, and remember the water, and the covenant, all this stuff? I mean, this is a big moment, and the fire comes down. God plays. Hey, we're going to go all the way with this. And Elijah actually ends up killing all of those alternative stories, so to speak. He wipes them out, 450 of them. And in the very next chapter, you get this. So frame that a little bit as we read the text. Think about, he just came off what would seem to be momentum for a prophet. It's actually starting to go the way it needs to go. That these false prophets are being vanquished, but Elijah turns. So I want to just frame that a little bit, and we'll read it in two sections. One is more of a setup, 19 verses 1 through 9, and then we'll do the interaction with God in the next, and we'll be done. Now Ahab told Jezebel everything Elijah had done, that's the thing that I was just talking about, and how he had killed all the prophets with the sword. So Jezebel sent a messenger to Elijah to say, "May the gods deal with me, be it ever so severely, if by this time tomorrow I do not make your life like that of one of them." Elijah was afraid and ran for his life. When he came to Beersheba in Judah, he left his servant there while he himself went a day's journey into the desert. He came to a broom tree, sat down under it, and prayed that he might die. "I have had enough, Lord," he said. "Take my life, I am no better than my ancestors." Then he lay down under the tree and fell asleep. All at once an angel touched him and said, "Get up and eat." He looked around, and there by his head was a cake of bread baked over hot coals and a jar of water. He ate and drank and then lay down again. The angel of the Lord came back a second time and touched him and said, "Get up and eat, for the journey is too much for you." So he got up and ate and drank. Strengthened by that food, he traveled 40 days and 40 nights until he reached Horeb, the mountain of God. There he went into a cave and spent the night. We're doing a hard turn into a new story here. But look at Elijah and his choice coming off of that victory. Just tell me what you notice, a couple details that in that reading kind of pop out a little. Elijah. This is the great prophet, by the way. Remember Matthew 17, right? What happens in Matthew 17? They have a vision. Who's there? Moses and Elijah. This is a big figure representing the tradition of the prophets.
After the big victory, he's afraid.
Yeah. And afraid of particularly what?
Death.
I mean, he's afraid of dying. And yet, what's his prayer?
Well, he's afraid of dying by Jezebel.
It's probably the way he's going to die.
It may be so, yeah. Maybe.
Jezebel's wicked.
Jezebel's a certain kind of animal, right? That he's afraid of what's going to come with this. And he's done a pretty dirty deed to her, has he not? And he seems to understand the power now.
She's ISIS.
I don't know if I really... I don't want to jump several centuries with that remark, so we'll leave that alone. There's a lot of ways to read Jezebel. Anybody name their grandchildren Jezebel?
All right. It sounds so good.
It sounds good, doesn't it? A little ring to it. What else about this moment? He's afraid. He's come off a victory. What else? What's his plan with his fear?
He's planned for when he's going to die, not letting God decide.
Well, he's trying to box God out, isn't he? After that moment, again, fire from the sky, quite literally, he says, "I'm kind of done now." Wow, I mean, 180 degrees from this fearlessness to total fear and total isolation.
Okay. Well, he doesn't see that it accomplished its purpose.
There you go. For whatever reason, it feels like the mountain meant nothing. why is Jezebel, why did she not get it? I killed all of her prophets. It meant nothing. Can you feel that in the text a little bit? The kind of emotional response of, this is it. I am no better than what, my ancestors? How am I any different, God? You going to wipe me out? You going to kill me? Some of that language?
I think it didn't take long, Satan long to attack Elijah, actually.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, particularly through isolation and deprivation, right? Elijah has no plan for food, which is interesting.
When I read that, it reminded me of what Steve says about recovery.
Yeah.
Don't get halt.
Hungry, too alone.
Hungry, angry, lonely, or tired.
And he was all of them.
Yeah. Yeah, vulnerable through
very, vulnerable.
Very basic human needs, yes. Right? And you see this, if I can go down a little bit of a trail, but with addicts, a little bit, there is a sense of deprivation of basic need feeds the illness. Does that make sense? Yeah. That's a different discussion for another day. What else about this with Elijah that you want to put a finger on and just say, hmm?
Well, God never gave him another plan. He just said, eat and prepare food, and then, oh, all right.
Yeah.
Then he goes on again.
Yeah, this is really unclear, isn't it?
Still got a plan. It didn't say, go back, you got to turn yourself around.
Yeah, no detail. So this is very much in the moment. Just eat. There is a sense of, and the word is used, the journey. You are not strong enough to take this journey. And then what is the journey that he takes? Which should immediately pop a bell based on some of the other stuff we've read. He goes to the wilderness for 40 days and 40 nights, and where does he end up? On the mountain of God. So here's that narrative coming back to life. Here's another broken person who has blood on his hands going to the mountain of God. Not sure what their life means anymore. Okay. So yeah, that's a big deal. Important. Okay. And then the number 40. Let's go to the next section because we're going to run out of time. And then we'll leave the prophet. Here you go. And the word of the Lord came to him, what are you doing here, Elijah? This is in the cave. He replied, I've been very zealous for the Lord God Almighty. The Israelites have rejected your covenant. They've broken down your altars and put your prophets to death with the sword. I am the only one left, and now they're trying to kill me too. The Lord said, go out and stand on the mountain in the presence of the Lord, for the Lord is about to pass by. That should sound familiar too, doesn't it? Then a great and powerful wind tore the mountains apart and shattered the rocks before the Lord, but the Lord was not in the wind. After the wind, there was an earthquake, but the Lord was not in the earthquake. And after the earthquake came a fire, but the Lord was not in the fire. And after the fire came a gentle whisper. When Elijah heard it, pulled his cloak over his face, and he went out, and he stood at the mouth of the cave. Then a voice said to him, what are you doing here, Elijah? He replied, I've been very zealous for the Lord God Almighty. The Israelites have rejected your covenant, broken down your altars, and put your prophets to death with a sword. I am the only one left, and now they are trying to kill me too. The Lord said to him, go back the way you came, and go to the desert of Damascus. When you get over there, anoint Hazael, king over Aram. Also anoint Jehu, son of Nimshi, king over Israel. And anoint Elisha, son of Shaphat from Abel-Meholah, to succeed you as prophet. Jehu will put to death any who escape the sword of Hazael, and Elisha will put to death any who escape the sword of Jehu. Yet I reserve 7,000 in Israel, all whose knees have not bowed down to Baal, and all whose mouths have not kissed him. All right. This is such a great story. I love this story. But why does it play out the way it does? When you listen to this, where is God going, and why does he choose this path in light of what Elijah is experiencing? What do you see in there? What does he want him to know?
I think one interesting thing is that, you know, in that moment, even when we're in that moment, we want God to just tell us it's going to be okay. Yeah. And that's going to be enough.
Yeah.
or to tell us what's going to happen. And maybe that's enough. But he doesn't do any of that. He expects that through the experience that we get of walking alongside of a plan he's already put in place is how we're going to get the hope, and we're going to encounter him. Yeah.
That the word you make me think of is participate, Elijah. Participate, Elijah. It's right there. Participate.
I thought it was interesting that after all of this, God comes up and says, "What'd you end up here for?"
Yeah. Twice, right?
Yeah.
A little narrative tool there to say.
He gives him food. He says, "You're ready for the journey. Here it is." But no details. He says, "Well, go on over here. Go on over there." But he says, "Well, now what'd you do? Where are you?"
Yeah. The why is kind of implicit there. What are you doing here? Have you noticed Elijah's response? It's almost a rote response. In other words, it repeats the argument. In other words, God, I'm going to put you on trial. Maybe you're not aware, maybe you don't have CNN wherever you live, but on my news channel, this is what it looks like. This is what the world is becoming, and now I'm all that's left. Legitimately, perhaps, but what is the information God provides to Elijah that disrupts this the most?
The truth
about both Elijah. You understand why you're here, and it's not because you want to participate. There's something else going, and he leaves it kind of open, doesn't he? Doesn't take him a task. Gives him an action plan at the end of the passage to say, "We'll go ahead and take care of some things. Don't need to sweat that." But that doesn't really answer the question of why you are here now. And then also that God, as judgment and hope continue to be connected, God is aware of things that Elijah simply cannot see. And that God's mission in the world is going to continue. Elijah, don't live in the cave. Even in the cave where I live on the mountain. Don't live in this place, because this is the calling and the mission that we're talking about, not over here. And I know you felt like maybe sleeping in this cave would be a great act, but it's not. This is the great act over here.
Sounds to me like God's treating depression.
Say again?
Sounds like to me God is treating depression.
Absolutely, yeah. And the self-affirming logic.
Yeah.
Can you hear that in there? Yeah.
Ezekiel so in himself.
Yeah, that's right.
I mean, Elijah. Himself here. And that's the way we are when we're depressed.
And I would give him just a measure of grace in the sense that he cannot see all that God is doing. And if we can kind of hold that ambiguity or that mystery and say, "I cannot see." Boy, when you're in a dark spot and you say, "I know I can't see all that's going on here," it does start to bring the light in a way. Steve, yeah?
Did he choose to go to Sinai, or did God lead him there?
That leaves it ambiguous, does it not? Except God's putting him on trial saying, "Why are you here?" Which could be read as an abandonment of mission, or this is the place I need to talk to you.
Because if he chose to go there, even in the confusion of where he is, he still chose to go and seek out God in that position. So I don't know, that's kind of interesting.
Yeah. There's a place, and Moses had the same experience, did he not? I mean, he goes up to the mountain, sees the burning bush, but then he's reoriented back towards, this is where I'm actually active in the world, Moses. I need this. I don't need you to stay on the mountain. We're done. I hear voices. Very good. Good discussion. Thank you.
Thank you.